Welcome to VetWatch at DVM360. I'm your host, Christopher Lee. We're talking today about rattlesnake vaccine and its potential loss from the marketplace. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Dale Wallace. She's a UC Davis graduate, such like myself, but in addition to her DVM, she also got an additional certificate in preventive medicine, which is fantastic. She was a director for Laboratory for Vaccines in the town of Davis, before she accepted a position at Hygieia Biologics Laboratories in 93. She quickly rose to become their vice president, and you may know that of their sister company, Red Rock Biologics. She is now the senior staff veterinarian at Red Rock Biologics, which manufactures the rattlesnake vaccine. Welcome, Dr. Wallace.
Thank you.
So tell us what's going on with the rattlesnake vaccine. It may be losing USDA renewal.
It has lost USDA renewal. We believe that the problem is that USDA has changed their policy on a category of licensing called limited market conditional licenses. Conditional licenses are issued where there is no commercial product, but there is a need, and the manufacturer has to show purity and safety and a reasonable expectation of efficacy to get this kind of license. It's issued for things like emergency conditions, like an outbreak of some sort, or in our case, we tend to specialize in something called limited market. This is where products are developed for addressing a problem, but the market is so small, it doesn't warrant the cost of full licensure. And so the history, I guess, on conditional licensing is that there's been no limit, no time limit to these. They just get renewed every year or every 2 years. USDA wants to see ongoing research for them, which we do. And that's just been the way it's been. Recently, they changed their mind and decided to time limit conditional limited market licenses. And in so doing, ours got timed out.
Because the rattlesnake vaccine has been on the market for quite a while. How long has it been?
21 years.
21 years, wow. And correct me if I'm wrong, there is no other rattlesnake vaccine on the market, correct?
To our knowledge, this is the only commercial vaccine against venom.
So if this is lost, there are no other options for rattlesnake vaccination other than treatment thereafter, is that correct?
Correct. Okay. Correct.
And how does the rattlesnake vaccine work? Can you walk us through that?
Sure. My partner and I both had cats that were bitten by rattlesnakes in Northern California, mine in 2002, his in 2003. And both cats nearly died. We were aware that, anecdotally at least, the stories were that a dog would get bit the first year and would get very, very sick, maybe nearly die. Get bit the second year, he would get sick, but not so bad. Third year, he'd swell up, but he wouldn't get sick. Fourth year, didn't even react to getting bit. And so there was evidence there for the dog being able to mount an immune response. We also have antivenom, which has been around for about 70 years, and it is generated by vaccinated animals over and over and over again to build up a titer. And when you do that, their serum then becomes something that will neutralize venom and can be given to a human or an animal to neutralize an envenomation if they suffer one. So we were aware that there was a biological basis not only for developing immunity to venom, but specifically that the dog could do it as well. And so we started working on developing technology to process venom into something that would make a vaccine. This is something the Army tried many years ago because of all of the troops in the jungles and that sort of thing, and it was never commercially viable. They never got something that would develop the kind of immunity needed and persist. We were successful. So there's been a lot of interest in figuring out what we did and how we did it. The testing for the vaccine, we started with mice, and the reason we started with mice is because antivenin is tested in mice. So antivenin is applied to dogs, cats, horses, people, August tested in mice. We figured the mice would be a good model to see if we were getting the kind of immunity we needed from this vaccine. Lo and behold, you vaccinate mice, you challenge them with venom, they survive where their controls don't. There is a paper published on this repeating our work, and it shows the vaccine is efficacious in the mouse. We looked at how dogs and mice seroconvert to the vaccine. They're virtually identical in terms of the scale of antibody generation. So we felt that the mouse would be a good model for the dog, and we applied for a license. And USDA issued the conditional license once we'd satisfied purity and safety and showed enough data to where they thought there was a reasonable expectation of efficacy. The USDA license issued in 2004.
That's a lot of information there with how that works and why it can be trusted. What is the protocol for vaccination of a pet?
When we did our work, we did it with border collies and greyhounds. Those are two species that are known to have somewhat different immune system responses, that is, suppressed or altered. And so we were trying to make sure that the vaccine we made would work for all breeds of dogs. When we did this, the dogs ranged in weight from about 35 pounds to about 70 pounds. And we found that two doses a month apart gave good immunity that persisted for at least 6 to 9 months. This would be enough for dogs in northern half of the United States because their rattlesnake season is about 6 to 9 months. In the southern part of the United States, sometimes there's year-round exposure to rattlesnakes. And so based on our work, the label is labeled for annual revaccination, but in the South, they have found that one dose every 6 months, two doses a year, is more beneficial for them. Border patrol dogs get three doses every 4 months just because of their higher level of exposures. When we did the studies, we then expanded to English Mastiffs and the dogs going up to 175 pounds. And we found that we didn't get the titer rise with two doses that we wanted. So we went back and gave a third dose to our group and found that they also achieved good titers, but it took the three doses. I don't know why the larger dogs have that issue, but they do. That's not on the label, that's just experimental research. The other change in the standard protocol of two doses is dogs under 25 pounds. They also get three doses, and the reason is not the same as for the Mastiffs. With a smaller dog, you have a smaller blood volume. So at the same titer, a 10-pound dog and a 50-pound dog will have a fivefold difference in their resistance to venom. Therefore, the smaller dog needs a higher titer, which we achieve by giving a third dose in the initial sequence. They do great with single-dose booster thereafter, but it takes three in the initial sequence.
Which makes sense with the fact that many times dogs that are smaller often can get more doses of anti-venom if they're being treated for this.
Exactly.
So again, for our viewers, what's the weight range where you give three doses for the small and the weight range for the large?
We're guesstimating about 25 pounds is the break point, and 100 pounds is a great point. So dogs between 25 and 100 pounds, standard two-dose sequence. Larger dogs and smaller dogs, three doses on the initial sequence, but then they need single-dose boosters like the mid-range dogs.
Roughly, do you know how many dogs are currently being supported by this vaccine, or how many doses are being roughly sold? Can you share that?
Roughly 500,000 doses a year.
Okay.
It's not a huge product in that sense. It's not something that the majors would be overly interested in, but it's certainly essential. We have about 150,000 dogs and cats that get envenomed by pit vipers in the United States every year, and approximately 5 to 10% of them die without vaccine. So it's a significant number of animals that are at risk.
That's a lot. That is a lot of pets.
Yes.
Now, with that, I think there's so many people that utilize this vaccine and are support this vaccine. I know several veterinarians that believe that they have witnessed firsthand how this vaccine has made a difference for some of their patients. On the other side, this vaccine is a bit controversial and it is mentioned in the AHA guidelines. I think some of those controversies are there. You touched upon the one. I'd like to talk about just three issues that are kind of detailed within the AHA guidelines for a moment. The first you touched upon, kind of that there's a concern of lack of data, that this is not, there's no dog studies, it's just a mouse study. Could you elaborate a little bit more on what you would say to people that were concerned about that?
Sure. Typically, when you go to make a vaccine, one of the pivotal efficacy studies is done in the host animal. So if I'm making a sheep vaccine, then I'm going to vaccinate sheep. If I'm making a cow vaccine, I'm going to vaccinate cows. And then I'm going to challenge them. I'm going to give them the illness and show that the vaccine worked in the host animal. When you're talking about envenomation, because of the pain, because of the long-term sequelae in terms of organ damage, we negotiated early on with USDA that we did not want to have to do a dog challenge study. And we worked out that since the immunity to the venom is entirely in the serum, we could vaccinate dogs. So we have the host animal vaccinated. But then instead of challenging the dog as the animal, we would challenge the serum from the dog. And we can do that in various ways. We can mix venom and serum and put it on cell culture. We can mix venom and serum and use various kits to measure the decrease in enzyme activity in the venom. We can take serum from vaccinated dogs, mix it with venom, and put it into mice and use the mouse as the detector. And when we do the mouse as the detector, we can do it at various levels of venom dosing, everything from everybody survives to 100% everybody dies. When you do this, you find that the dose of venom required to kill mice given vaccinated dog serum is much higher than the dose required to kill the mice without the serum. And so in that way, we have proven that the canine response to vaccination is neutralizing of venom and protective from death, from serious sequelae.
So much of this was ethical reasons to move to sort of an in vitro model.
Yes.
Okay. One of the other controversies, and is pointed out in the guidelines, is that there are reports of anaphylaxis in pets that were vaccinated and then envenomated. What would you respond to that?
I have put my response to that out on the Veterinary Information Network, if anybody wants to go look at it. But it took me 10 minutes online to find a dozen reports of anaphylaxis in people upon first exposure to venom. So venom itself can cause not anaphylaxis per se, where it's IgE mediated, but it's called anaphylactoid, where it goes through the platelets. And so venom itself is capable of causing an anaphylactoid reaction, independent of whether an animal is vaccinated or not. These people were not vaccinated, clearly, and they'd never had prior exposure to venom. Yet on a first exposure, they had this reaction that's clinically indistinguishable from anaphylaxis. Sadly, the authors of that paper did not do a literature search before they published. And so they put out what is effectively misinformation. If we were having an anaphylaxis problem with this vaccine in the 20 years we've had it out there, we'd have a lot more than two dogs being reported.
And you'd be having a lot more calls into your pharmacovigilance with repeated exposure just to the vaccine as well, correct?
Yes. Yes. And exactly. There's a discussion on the VIN pointing out that if these dogs were sensitized by the vaccine, then they should have reacted to multiple doses of the vaccine, and they didn't. And so this is independent of vaccination. This is a venom-mediated event.
Thank you for clarifying that. That helps. The last one was that rattlesnake venom by nature is heterogeneous, meaning that it varies. And we know
yes.
that by species and even within a species, simple relocation of rattlesnakes can change the venom fraction, or diet can affect that as well. And so there's a bit of a response that because the venom is so heterogeneous, that there is no cross protection. And so the whole concept of this vaccine is flawed. What would you respond to that?
If you look at the development of antivenom, Wyeth did this work, like I said, about 75 years ago. What they did was they mapped venom profiles. You can do a gel electrophoresis and you look at the banding patterns of the proteins. And they found that there were a lot of venoms that had banding in the same locations, meaning that at least the proteins were the same size. And I'm not privy to the work that they did that long ago, but they ultimately chose just two North American snakes to use their venom to cover all North American snakes. They added a Central American snake and a South American snake so that they would have both of the Americas covered as far as their immunity to venom. So if four snakes can cover the 70 plus species of pit viper in North and South America, that argues right there for an awful lot of cross protection. What we've seen, now remember, our cats were in Northern California. What we have here is the Northern Pacific rattlesnake. Yet the vaccine we chose to make from one of the two snakes chosen by Wyeth because of that cross protective factor. And I tell you, it works. I had a minpin that got hit by a snake after being vaccinated. He started to swell. Swelling reached its peak between 15 and 30 minutes after being bit. It was a witness bite, so I have the time. And then it stopped and started to recede. And by the following morning, he was back to normal. Okay, we're talking about a dog that was only 18 pounds maybe. And so that, you know, I wish I had a video. I wish I'd taken video, but I was more concerned with just monitoring him, making sure he was handling the dose of venom he got okay, which he was. He did fine. I did not take him into the clinic. And so I have firsthand knowledge of what happens in a witness bite in a snake that's not part of the vaccine.
A couple of follow-up questions. Okay. My understanding, too, is that even with venom being heterogeneous, there are maybe a dozen different molecules within the venom fraction that are consistent across rattlesnake species. Is that correct?
That's what Wyeth found. That's okay. Why they picked the snakes they did. Eastern and Western Diamondback were the two snakes that they picked the venom. They don't have a whole lot of overlap between their venoms, but their venoms overlap most of the snakes in the United States.
Excellent. And then with the vaccine, you'd mentioned that Minpin was fortunate enough that did not need follow-up care. But with the vaccine, my understanding is that whether the pet's been vaccinated or not, the recommendation is to immediately seek care and then rely upon the veterinarian to move forward from there. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Remember, I am a veterinarian, so I was monitoring my dog pretty close.
Yes, of course.
No, we do recommend that animals which are bitten, vaccinated or not, be seen by a veterinarian. And the purpose for that is something that you kind of see out of the human literature. On presentation, human and venom patients, about 30% that are classified as mild on presentation become severe over the course of the next 12 hours. And so mild envenomations in people don't get antivenom. Severe ones do. And they get it in the multiple tens of vials. So if you can have an animal present with what looks like mild, you've got to monitor and see if that animal is progressing in disease. If they're progressing, absolutely antivenom is warranted. There is no interference between the vaccine and antivenom, so there's no risk there, no additional risk there to using antivenom.
The other question, we've talked a little bit about small dogs, medium dogs, large dogs, and we've mentioned cats a few times. But this vaccine is a canine-only vaccine, correct?
It's only labeled for dogs. And the reason for that is that it's got an aluminum adjuvant. Cats are more sensitive to aluminum. They're more prone to having a strong inflammatory response. And when I came through school, vaccine-associated sarcomas were just on the, you know, just had been discovered. We've backed away from some of the scare that happened early on, but my early training was, you don't want to have one of these. And so we looked at what it would take to make a vaccine for cats. And unfortunately, we ran into the same problems that the Army did in that you don't get the titers and you don't get the duration if you don't have a good adjuvant in there. And so it has aluminum adjuvant. Now, with that said, my cats are vaccinated. I have snakes in my yard every single year. My cats are vaccinated. The sarcoma risk is present. It is known to run in families. So if you have related cats that have are related to one that's had a sarcoma, maybe this is not a good idea. But for the most part, my chances of my cats getting hit by a rattlesnake were 1 out of 2. And the chances of a sarcoma at the scariest number was 1 in 10,000. And so for me, the numbers just worked out. It was safer to vaccinate than to not. But no, it won't be labeled for cats because of the restriction on the adjuvant.
With the vaccine not being renewed, what are we looking for as far as people being able to order that now? When will that supply run out?
Very soon. Shelf life on the vaccine is 2 years from date of manufacture. And our last serials run out in August and October. And I very much doubt that there's going to be any supply left through those months. I expect it to run out very soon. We are trying to get USDA to rescind this policy change. There's no reason for it. And if we're successful, then we will ramp up and restock inventory. But right now, we can't make any more.
So for people that do want to help out, those that support this vaccine, veterinarians, technicians, professionals, what can they do to help keep this vaccine on the market?
At this point, we are mounting a campaign where we've sent letters to veterinary clinics that have ordered the vaccine and asked them to write to USDA and let them know their experiences with the vaccine and ask for the license to be reinstated. We are recruiting congresspeople. In our area, we've got Doug LaMalfa in the northern part of the state and Mike Thompson in our area that their offices have gotten involved. Whether they're successful or not, we don't know. We have written to the higher-ups at USDA that are over the Center for Veterinary Biologics to see if we can get some pressure there. At this point, if somebody is so inclined, if they've got an experience with the vaccine that they want to share, we ask that you go ahead and write to Dr. Srinivas and copy us so that we're aware of the letters going in.
I appreciate you being on here. For listeners and viewers, links to the paper that was sent out, additional links to Red Rock Biologics, and some papers will be in the feed. Dr. Wallace, is there anything else you'd like to add onto our conversation today?
I don't know how many times I've had people call me up and tell me, thank you for the vaccine. We were 3 hours away from a clinic and my dog made it, even though it was a bad bite. This is in Texas with large Crotalus atrox, the Western Diamondback. And so the vaccine slows the venom down enough to give you time to get to the vet. It also decreases the overall dose, the effective dose that the dog experiences. And so it's a twofer. You don't see the sloughing of tissue that you do in unvaccinated dogs. You don't see the pain. You don't see the delayed organ failures. So there's an awful lot of animals that are going to really be hurting if we don't get the license back.
Well, thank you, Dr. Wallace. Thank you for your time. This is VetWatch at DVM 360, where what you know today protects everybody tomorrow.